Sometimes Lord Vetinari wondered what had happened to Mr. Hong. Everyone knew, of course, in general terms. But not exactly what. What a city. In the spring, the river caught fire. About once a month, the Alchemist's Guild exploded. He walked back to his desk and made another brief note. He was rather afraid that he was going to have someone killed. Then he picked up the third movement of Fondel's Prelude in G Major and settled back to read. Susan walked back to the alley where she'd left Binky. There were half a dozen men lying around on the cobbles, clutching parts of themselves and moaning. Susan ignored them. Anyone trying to steal Death's horse soon understood the expression, a world of hurts. Binky had a good aim. It would be a very small, very private world.
"The music was playing him, not the other way round," she said. "You could see. I'm not sure his fingers even touched the strings."
"Squeak!"
Susan rubbed her hand. Satchel Mouth had turned out to have quite a hard head.
"Can I kill it without killing him?"
"Squeak!"
"Not a hope," the raven translated. "It's all that's keeping him alive."
"But Grandad... But he said it'll end up killing him anyway."
"It's a big, wide, wonderful universe, all right," said the raven.
"Squeak!"
"But look, if it's a parasite or something like that," said Susan, as Binky trotted skywards, "what's the good of it killing its host?"
"Squeak!"
"He says, you've got him there," said the raven. "Drop me off over Quirm, will you?"
"What does it want him for?" said Susan. "It's using him, but what for?"
$27, said Ridcully. $27 to get you out, and the sergeant kept grinning all the time. Wizards arrested. Oh.
He walked along the row of crestfallen figures.
I mean, how often does the watch get called in to the drum? Said Ridcully. I mean, what did you think you were doing?
Mumble, 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 said the dean, looking at the floor.
I'm sorry?
Mumble, 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 dancing, mumble, mumble, mumble.
"Dancing," said Ridcully levelly, walking back along the row. "That's dancing, is it? Banging into people, throwing one another over your shoulders, twirling around all over the place. Not even trolls act like that. Not that I've got anything against trolls, mind you. Marvellous people, marvellous people. And you're supposed to be... wizards. People are supposed to look up to you, and that's not because you're somersaulting over their heads. Runes. Don't think I didn't notice that little display. I was frankly disgusted. The poor bursar has had to have a lie down. Dancing is round in circles, don't you know? Maypoles and such like, healthy reels, perhaps a little light ballroom. Not swinging people round like a dwarf with a battle axe. Mind you, salt of the earth dwarfs, I've always said so. Do I make myself clear?"
"Mumble, mumble, mumble, mumble. Everyone was doing it, mumble, mumble," said the dean, still looking at the floor.
"I never thought I'd say this to any wizard over the age of 18, but you're all gated until further notice," shouted Ridcully.
Being confined to the campus was not much of a punishment. The wizards usually distrusted any air that hadn't hung around indoors for a while, and mostly lived in a kind of groove between their rooms at the dining table. But they were feeling strange.
"Mumble, mumble, mumble, don't see why, mumble, mumble," mumbled the dean.
He said, much later on the day when the music died, that it must have been because he'd never been really young, or at least young while just being old enough to know he was young. Like most wizards, he'd begun his training while still so small that the official pointy hat came down over his ears. And after that, he'd just been, well, a wizard. He had the feeling once again that he'd missed out on something somewhere. He'd never really realized it until the last couple of days. He didn't know what it was. He just wanted to do things. He didn't know what they were, but he wanted to do them soon. He felt like a lifelong tundra dweller when he wakes up one morning with a deep urge to go water skiing. He certainly wasn't going to stay indoors when there was music in the air.
Mumble, 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 not going to stay indoors, mumble, mumble.
Unaccustomed feelings surged through him. He wanted to disobey everything, including the law of gravity. He was definitely not going to fold his clothes before going to bed. Ridcully was going to say, "Oh, you're a rebel, are you? What are you rebelling against?" And he'd say something pretty damn memorable, that's what he'd do. But the Arch-Chancellor had stalked off. "Mumble, mumble, mumble," said the Dean defiantly, a rebel without a pause. There was a knock at the door, barely audible above the din. Cliff opened it a cautious fraction.
"It's me, Hibiscus. Here's your beers. Drink 'em up and get out." "How can we get out?" said Glod. "Every time they see us, they force us to play some more."
Hibiscus shrugged. "I don't care," he said, "but you owe me $1 for the beer and $25 for the broken furniture." Cliff shut the door.
"I could negotiate with him," said Glod.
"No, we can't afford it," said Buddy.
They looked at one another.
"Well, the crowd loved us," said Buddy. "I think we were a big success.
In the silence, Cliff bit the end off a beer bottle and poured the contents over his head. Troll beer is ammonium sulphide dissolved in alcohol and tastes like drinking fermented batteries.
"What we all want to know is," said Glod, "what you thought you were doing out there."
"Ooh! And how come," said Cliff, crunching up the rest of the bottle, "we all knew what to play?"
"Ooh!" "And also," said Glod, "what you were singing."
"Don't tread on my new blue boots," said Cliff.
"Ooh!" "Good gracious, Miss Polly," said Glod.
"Stow hell it lace," said Cliff.
"Ooh!" "It's a kind of very fine lace they make in the city of Stowhellit," said Glod.
Glod gave Buddy a lopsided look.
"That bit where you said, 'Hello, baby,'" he said. "Why'd you do that?"
I mean,
it's not as if they even allow small children into the drum."
"I don't know. The words were just there," said Buddy. "They were sort of part of the music."
"And you were moving about in a funny way, like you were having trouble with your trousers," said Glod. "I'm not the expert on humans, of course, but I saw some ladies in the audience looking at you like a dwarf looks at a girl when he knows her father's got a big shaft and several rich seams."
"Yeah," said Cliff, "and like when a troll is thinking, 'Hey, will you look at Destrata on that one?'"
"You're certain you've got no elvish in you, are you?" said Glod. "Once or twice I thought you were acting a bit elvish."
"I don't know what's happening," said Buddy.
The guitar whined. They looked at it.
"What we do is," said Cliff, "we take that and we throw it in the river. All those in favour say aye, or ook, as the case may be."
There was another silence. No one rushed to pick up the instrument.
"But the thing is," said Glod, "the thing is, they did love us out there."
They thought about this.
"It didn't actually feel bad," said Buddy.
"Got to admit, I never had an audience like that in my whole life," said Cliff.
"Ooh, ooh, ooh." "If we're so good," said Glod, "why aren't we rich?"
"'Cause you do the negotiating," said Cliff. "If we've got to pay for the furniture, I'm soon going to have to eat my dinner through a straw."
"You saying I'm no good?" said Glod, getting angrily to his feet.
"You blow good horn, but you ain't no financial wizard."
"Heh, I'd just like to see—"
There was a knock on the door. Cliff sighed.
"That'll be Hibiscus again," he said. "Pass me that mirror. I'll try to hit one out on the other side."
Buddy opened the door. Hibiscus was there, but behind a smaller man, wearing a long coat and a wide, friendly grin.
"Ah," said the grin, "you be Buddy, right?"
Yes.
And then the man was inside, without actually appearing to have moved, and kicking the door shut in the landlord's face.
"Dibbler's the name,"
the grin went on.
"C-M-O-T, Dibbler. I dare say you've heard of me."
"Ooh, ooh, 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 ooh.
I ain't talking to you. I'm talking to you other guys."
"No," said Buddy, "I don't think we have."
The grin appeared to widen.
"I hear you boys are in a bit of trouble," said Dibbler. "Broken furniture and what not."
"We're not even going to get paid," said Cliff, glaring at Glod.
"Well now," said Dibbler, "it could just be that I could help you there. I'm a businessman. I do
business. I can see you boys are musicians. You play music. You don't want to worry your heads about money stuff, right? Gets in the way of the creative processes, am I right? How about if you leave that to me?
Hmm, said Glod, still smarting from the insult to his financial acumen.
And what can you do? Well,
said Dibbler,
I can get you paid for tonight for a start.
What about the furniture?
Said Buddy.
Oh, stuff gets busted here every night,
said Dibbler expansively.
Hibiscus was just having you on. I'll square it with him. Confidentially, you want to watch out for people like him.
He leaned forward. If his grin had been any wider, the top of his head would have fallen off.
This city, boys, he said, is a jungle.
If he can get us paid, I trust him, said Glod.
As simple as that, said Cliff.
I'll trust anyone who gives me money.
Buddy glanced at the table. He didn't know why, but he had a feeling that if something was wrong, the guitar would do something, play a discord, maybe. But it just purred gently to itself.
Oh, all right. If it means I get to keep my teeth, I'm all for it, said Cliff.
Okay,
said Buddy.
Great, great. We can make beautiful music together. At least you boys can, eh?
He pulled out a sheet of paper and a pencil. In Dibbler's eyes, the lion roared. Somewhere high in the ram tops, Susan rode Binky over a cloud bank.
How could he talk like that, she said, play around with people's lives, and then talk about duty?
All the lights were on in the Musicians' Guild. A gin bottle played a tattoo on the edge of a glass, then it rattled briefly on the desktop as Satchelmouth put it down.
"Doesn't anyone know who the hells they are?"
Mr. Cleet said, as Satchelmouth managed to grip the glass on the second try.
"Someone must know who they are."
"Dunno about the boy," said Satchelmouth. "No one's ever seen him before. And, well, you know trolls. Could have been anyone."
"One of them was definitely the librarian from the university," said Herbert, Mr. Harpsichord Shuffle, the Guild's own librarian.
"We can leave him for now,"
said Cleet. The others nodded. No one really wanted to attempt to beat up the librarian if there was anyone smaller available.
"What about the dwarf?"
"Oh."
Someone said they thought he was Glod Glodson. Lives in Phaedra Road somewhere.
Cleet growled.
"Get some of the lads over there right now. I want the position of musicians in this city explained to them right now."
The musicians hurried through the night, the din of the mended drum behind them.
"Wasn't he nice?" said Glod. "I mean, we haven't just got our pay, but he was so interested he gave us $20 of his own money."
"I think what he said," said Cliff, "was that he'd give us $20 with interest."
"Same thing, isn't it? And he said he could get us more jobs. Did you read the contract?"
"Did you?"
"It was very small writing," said Glod.
He brightened up.
"But there was a lot of it," he added. "Bound to be a good contract, with that much writing on it."
"The librarian ran away," said Buddy. "Ooked a lot, and ran away."
"Eh, well, he'll be sorry later on," said Glod. "Later on, people'll talk to him, and he'll say, 'I left, you know, before they became famous.'
He'll say, 'Ook.'
Anyway, that piano's going to need some work."
"Yeah," said Cliff. "Like I saw once where this guy made stuff out of matches. He could repair it."
A couple of dollars became two lamb kormas and pitch-blend vindaloo at the Curry Gardens, along with a bottle of wine so chemical that even trolls could drink it.
"And after this," said Glod, as they sat down to wait for the food, "we'll find somewhere else to stay."
"What's wrong with your place?"
said Cliff.
"It's too draughty. It's got a piano-shaped hole in the door."
"Yeah, but you put it there."
"So what?"
"Won't the landlord object?"
"Of course he'll object. That's what landlords are for. Anyway, we're on the up and up, lads. I can feel it in my water."
"I thought you were just happy to get paid," said Buddy.
"Right, right, but I'm even happier to get paid a lot."
The guitar hummed. Buddy picked it up and plucked a string. Glod dropped his knife.
"That sounded like a piano," he said.
"I think it can sound like anything," said Buddy. "And now it knows about pianos."
Magic? Said Cliff. Of course magic, said God. That's what I keep saying, a strange old thing found in a dusty old shop one stormy night.
It wasn't stormy, said Cliff.
It's bound to... Yes, all right, but it was raining a bit. It's bound to be a bit special. I bet if we was to go back now, the shop wouldn't be there, and that'd prove it. Everyone knows things bought from shops which aren't there the next day are dead mysterious, and items of fate. Fate smiling on us.
Could be.
Doing something on us, said Cliff. I hope it's smiling.
And Mr. Dibbler said he'd find us somewhere really special to play tomorrow.
Good, said Buddy. We must play.
Right, said Cliff. We play all right. It's our job.
People should hear our music.
Sure, Cliff looked puzzled. Right, of course. That's what we want. And some pay, too.
Mr. Dibbler'll help us, said Glod, who was too preoccupied to notice the edge in Buddy's voice. He must be very successful. He's got an office in Sator Square. Only very posh businesses can afford that.
A new day dawned. It had hardly finished doing so before Ridcully hurried through the dewy grass of the University Gardens and hammered on the door of the High Energy Magic Building. Generally, he never went near the place. It wasn't that he didn't understand what it was the young wizards in there were actually doing, but because he strongly suspected that they didn't too. They seemed to positively enjoy becoming less and less certain about everything, and would come into dinner saying things like, "Wow! We've just overturned Marrow Leaf's theory of thalmic imponderability. Amazing!" as if it was something to be proud of, instead of gross discourtesy. And they were always talking about splitting the thaum, the smallest unit of magic. The Arch-Chancellor couldn't see the point. So you had bits all over the place. What good would that do? The universe was bad enough without people poking it. The door opened.
"Oh, it's you, Arch-Chancellor."
Ridcully pushed the door open further.
"Morning, Stibbons. Glad to see you're up and about early."
Ponder Stibbons, the faculty's youngest member, blinked at the sky.
"Dad, is it morning already?"
he said. Ridcully pushed his way past him and into the H.E.M. It was unfamiliar ground for a traditional wizard. There wasn't a skull or dribbly candle to be seen. This particular room looked like an alchemist's laboratory had suffered the inevitable explosion and landed in a blacksmith's shop. Nor did he approve of Stibbons's robe. It was the right length, but a washed-out greeny-grey, with pockets and toggles, and a hood with a bit of rabbit fur around the edge. There weren't any sequins or jewels or mystic symbols anywhere. Just a blodgy stain where Stibbons' pen leaked.
"You ain't been out lately?" said Ridcully. "No, sir. Should I have been? I've been busy working on my make-it-bigger device. You know, I showed you..."
Not with very good results, however. Stibbons spent weeks grinding lenses and blowing glassware, and had finally produced a device which showed the tremendous amount of tiny animals there were in one drop of water from the River Ankh. The Arch-Chancellor had taken a look and then remarked that anything in which that much life could exist had to be healthy.
Right, said Ridcully, looking around. "Anyone else been working in here?" "Well, there's me, and Tez the Terrible, and Skaz, and Big Mad Drongo, I think."
Ridcully blinked.
"What are they?" he said.
And then, from the depths of memory, a horrible answer suggested itself. Only a very specific species had names like that.
Students?
Yes, said Ponder, backing away. That's all right, isn't it? I mean, this is a university.
Ridcully scratched his ear. The man was right, of course. You had to have some of the buggers around. There was no getting away from it. Personally, he avoided them whenever possible, as did the rest of the faculty, occasionally running the other way or hiding behind doors whenever they saw them. The lecturer in recent rooms had been known to lock himself in his wardrobe rather than take a tutorial.
You'd better fetch him, he said. The fact is, I seem to have lost my faculty. For what, Arch-Chancellor?
Said Ponder politely.
What?
Sorry?
They looked at one another in incomprehension, two minds driving opposite ways up a narrow street and waiting for the other man to reverse first.
"The faculty," said Ridcully, giving up. "The dean, and what not.
gone totally round the corner. Been up all night playing guitars and what not. The Dean's made himself a coat out of leather.
Well, leather is a very practical and functional material.
Not the way he's using it, said Ridcully darkly. The Dean stood back. He'd borrowed a dressmaker's dummy from Mrs. Whitlow, the housekeeper. He'd made some changes to the design that had buzzed round his brain. For one thing, a wizard in his very soul is loath to wear any garment that doesn't reach down at least to the ankles. So there was quite a lot of leather. Lots of room for all the studs. He'd started with Dean. That had hardly begun to fill the space, and after a while he'd added born to, and left a space because he wasn't quite sure what he'd been born to. Born to eat big dinners wouldn't be appropriate, and after some more bemused thought, he'd gone on to live farts, die yogn. It wasn't quite right, he could see. He turned the material over when he was making the holes for the studs, and had sort of lost track of which direction he was going. Of course, it didn't matter which direction you went, just so long as you went. That's what music with rocks in it was all about. And Recent Runes is in his room playing drums, and the rest of them have all got guitars. And what the bursar's done to the bottom of his robe is really strange, said Ridcully. And the librarian's wandering around the place pinching stuff, and no one listens to a word I say. He stared at the students. It was a worrying sight, and not just because of the natural look of students. Here were some people who, while this damn music was making everyone tap their feet, had stayed indoors all night, working. What are you lot doing in here? He said. You, what's your name? The student wizard, pinned by Ridcully's pointing finger, squirmed anxiously.
Big Mad Drongo, he said, twisting the brim of his hat in his hands.
Big Mad Drongo, said Ridcully. That's your name, is it? That's what you've got sewn on your vest?
No, Arch-Chancellor.
It is?
Adrian Turnipseed, Arch-Chancellor.
So why are you called, Big Mad Drongo, Mr. Turnipseed? Said Ridcully.
He once drank a whole pint of shandy, said Stibbons,
who had the decency to look embarrassed. Ridcully gave him a carefully blank look. Oh, well, they'd have to do. All right, you lot, he said. What do you make of this? He produced from his robe a mended drum beer tankard with a beer mat fastened over the top with a piece of string.
What have you got in there, Arch-Chancellor? Said Ponder Stibbons. A piece of music, lad. Music? But you can't trap music like that. I wish I was a clever bugger like you and knew every damn thing, said Ridcully. That big flask over there, you, big mad Adrian, take the top off it, and be ready to slam it down again when I say. Ready with that lid, mad Adrian? Right.
There was a brief angry chord as Ridcully pulled the beer mat off the mug and upended it quickly into the flask. Mad Drongo Adrian slammed the lid down in total terror of the Arch-Chancellor. And then they could hear it, a persistent, faint beat rebounding off the inner walls of the glass flask. The students peered in at it. There was something in there, a sort of movement in the air.
I trapped it in the drum last night. That's not possible, said Ponder. You can't trap music.
That isn't Clatchian mist, lad.
It's been in that mug since last night, said Ponder.
Yes.
But that's not possible.
Ponder looked absolutely crestfallen. There are some people born with the instinctive feeling that the universe is solvable. Ridcully patted him on the shoulder.
You never thought that being a wizard was going to be easy, did you?
Ponder stared at the jar, and then his mouth snapped into a thin line of determination.
Right. We're going to sort this out. It must be something to do with the frequency, that's right. Tez the Terrible, get the crystal ball. Skaz, fetch the roll of steel wire. It must be the frequency.
The band with rocks in slept the night away in a single male's hostel in an alley off Gleam Street, a fact that would have interested the four enforcers of the Musicians' Guild sitting outside a piano-shaped hole in Phaedra Road. Susan strode through the rooms of death, seething gently with anger and just a touch of fear, which only made the anger worse. How could anyone even think like that? How could anyone be content to just be the personification of a blind force? Well, there were going to be changes. Her father had tried to change things, she knew, but only because he was, well, quite frankly, a bit soppy. He'd been made a duke by Queen Kaylee of Stolat. Susan knew what the title meant. Duke meant war leader. But her father never fought anyone. He seemed to spend all his time travelling from one wretched city-state to another, all over the Stow Plains, just talking to people and trying to get them to talk to other people. He'd never killed anyone, as far as Susan knew, although he may have talked a few politicians to death. That didn't seem to be much of a job for a war leader. Admittedly, there didn't seem to be all the little wars there used to be, but it was, well, not a proud kind of life. She walked through the Hall of Lifetimers. Even those on the highest shelves rattled gently as she passed. She'd save lives. The good could be spared and the bad could die young. It would all balance up, too. She'd show him. As for responsibility, well, humans always made changes. That was what being human was all about. Susan opened another door and stepped into the library. It was a room even bigger than the Hall of Lifetimers. Bookcases rose like cliffs. A haze obscured the ceiling. But of course it'd be childish, she told herself, to think that she could go in waving the scythe like a magic wand and turn the world into a better place overnight. It might take some time. So she should start in a small way and work out. She held out a hand. "I'm not going to do the voice," she said. "That's just unnecessary drama and really a bit stupid. I just want the book of Imp y Celyn, thank you very much." Around her, the busyness of the library went on. Millions of books quietly carried on writing themselves, causing a rustle like that of cockroaches. She remembered sitting on a knee, or rather sitting on a cushion on a knee, because the knee itself had been out of the question, watching a bony finger follow the letters as they formed on the page. She'd learned to read her own life. "I'm waiting," said Susan, meaningfully. She clenched her fists. "Imp y Celyn," she said. The book appeared in front of her. She just managed to catch it before it fluttered to the floor. "Thank you," she said. She flicked through the pages of his life until she came to the last one and stared. Then she hastily went back until she found written neatly down his death in the drum. It was all there, all untrue. He hadn't died. The book was lying. Or, and this she knew was a far more accurate way of looking at it, the book was true and reality was lying. What was more important was that from the moment of his death, the book was writing music. Page after page had been covered with neat staves. While Susan watched, a clef drew itself in a series of careful loops. What did it want? Why should it save his life? And it was vitally important that she save him instead. She could feel the certainty like a ball bearing in her mind. It was absolutely imperative. She'd never met him up close. She'd not exchanged a word with him. He was just one person. But it was him she had to save. Grandfather had said she shouldn't do that sort of thing. What did he know about anything? He'd never lived.